March 30th. We have three bills in front of us today. If you would, call the roll, please.
President
Here.
President
Metcalf. Here.
President Colbert.
Here.
President Johnson.
Here.
President Heitkamp. President Paulus.
Here.
Chair Kelly.
Here.
Thank you.
Okay. House Education Committee, we got in front of us today HB 130 and then HB 156 and then HB 163. So we'll start with 130. Representative Keto, if you'd come up and introduce yourself. Just to clarify, to make sure we're all on the same page, Madam Vice Chair, what is the version in front of us?
Mr. Chairman, the version before us is 29-LS0669/A, capital A.
Okay, so go ahead and...
To be a working document for consideration.
Right, right.
Do I hear an objection?
Oh, no, it is. No? That's okay, Madam Chair. That's the one they brought, so that's the one. So okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sam Keto, Representative of District 33, and with me is my staff, Bianca Carpinetti, and today we've got House Bill 130.
That's the version I have.
Go ahead.
There you go. I'm going to go ahead and read through the bits of the sponsor statement to kind of give a sense for what we're looking at. House Bill 130 designates the new Division of Library, Archives, and Museums building in Juneau as the father... Andrew P. Cacheveroff State Library, Archives, and Museum. The state of Alaska...
Excuse me, I'm really sorry, Representative Keto. I got ahead of myself and I was wrong. The Vice Chair was absolutely right. That was supposed to be a motion because there is a CS, an education CS in front of us. So let's try to delete the last 30 seconds here and we'll go back to the Vice Chair. Do you have a motion for us, Madam Chair?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I move to consider the following House Bill number 130.
No, this one right here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Version 29-LS0669/W to be our working document for consideration.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And now you made the right motion. I just heard it wrong. So I see no objection. So that's the working copy in front of us. So now, if you would, just start right over and you will give your...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was going to mention, we do have a working draft CS that is the version that is now before us that actually, in addition to naming the library, adds the Richard Foster Reading Room that was added in the other body. And so now our version will match that other version. There are other people that can speak to some other components of the bill. I was going to go ahead and read through the sponsor statement, set the stage for what we're working on here. So, again, House Bill 130 designates the Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums building in Juneau as the Father P. Andrew P. Cacheveroff State Library, Archives, and Museum. The state of Alaska is building this new facility for the division to protect, preserve, and share its collections of objects, books, documents, photos, and records of the state's culture and history. The building's nicknamed the SLAM, State Library, Archives, and Museum, and is scheduled to open in the spring of 2016. And now it's time to choose a more formal name for the facility. I think it would be not quite stately to have SLAM across the front of the building, so having a regular name. And now is the time actually to do this because we do have to go through and have the name put onto the building as it's being built. It's fitting to name the building after Russian Orthodox priest Father Andrew P. Cacheveroff. Father Cacheveroff was an Alaskan scholar, the museum's first creator, and the library's first librarian. A descendant of Russian explorers and Alaska natives, the forerunner of the division's efforts to share Alaska's history and culture collaboratively across disciplines. In November of 1919, Father Cacheveroff, renowned for his knowledge of Russian history and Alaska natives, began a 20-year career as a librarian and curator for the Historical Museum and Library. Father Cacheveroff was a vocal and energetic advocate for the museum and library, and today he's fondly remembered as its true founding father. He was uniquely suited for the position. His Russian ancestors were navigators and colonists who came to Alaska in the 1700s, and married Alutiiq or Creole women around Kodiak. Born there in 1863 during the Russian administration of Alaska, he dedicated his life to serving the Russian Orthodox Church while maintaining his interest in Alaska's history and culture. He was considered a leading authority in Alaska and became a popular lecturer and author. The combination of his Russian-Alaska native heritage and his ability to live and work in America afforded him special access to both cultures, which helped him develop and lead the distinctly Alaskan institution. Museum visitors found Father Kashevarov a memorable character. Many elderly Alaskans fondly remember how he encouraged them as children to hang out in the old museum after school, to wander among the picturesque displays, and to listen to his adventurous stories. In the summers, he was on call to open the museum at any hour of the day for visiting steamship passengers. Naming the new State Libraries, Archives, and Museums building in honor of this historic Alaskan will recognize and preserve the legacy of Father Kashevarov in a most fitting manner. So thank you for your support of House Bill 130. And I would also add, we do have representatives from the department here to answer questions and talk about the name selection process.
Representative Keto, does any questions for the sponsor from the committee? And for the record, Representative Christ Tompkins has joined us. Thanks. Silence. Okay, we'll go right to testimony then. Thank you for bringing the bill. We have in the room, we have Linda Thibodeau from the Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums. You're here to answer questions, but did you have anything that you wanted to add?
Good morning. My name is Linda Thibodeau, for the record, and I'm the director of the Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums. And I would just like to thank the committee and the House for considering this bill. We are very excited about the naming of our new facility for Father Kashevarov, and also very content with the naming of the reading room for Representative Foster, who spent many hours in our reading room and studying Alaskan history. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Seeing none at this time, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody in the room else that would like to testify on HB 130? Anybody online? I don't have any record of anybody online, so we'll close public testimony. It's before the committee for comments or action. Representative Drummond and then Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been very exciting for me as a fairly new representative quarterly resident of Juneau to watch this building go up. I took a hard hat tour when most of it was still in the ground a couple of years ago, and it's just exciting to see it come back to life. I wish it was open during this time, but I understand exactly how that works. It's an amazing structure that is designed to protect millions of dollars worth of priceless, actually, never mind millions, it's priceless. And I'm very pleased to be able to approve of this name. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't have any familiarity with Father Kashevarov, but I'm pleased to see in the CES the Richard Foster Reading Room. I have fond memories of Representative Foster bringing us so much history that he would spend time at the State Library and bring us some really great stories of our past. So I think that's very appropriate, and thank you.
Thank you. Representative Culver.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do think it's pretty interesting that we name it after the father who has a Russian Alaskan heritage and was actually involved as a librarian. And I think that's pretty unique to be able to tie that back to our history. And so that may be pretty appropriate centuries down the road for people to recognize our Russian-American heritage and Alaskan heritage. Thank you.
Madam Vice Chair.
Yes, I move that we move for consideration.
No, move the bill.
Yes, move the bill.
Version W, okay. That's version W with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note. Any question or any objection? None? Okay, so HB 130 moves. Wasn't that easy? Wish they were all that easy. Madam Chair, we're going, Vice Chair, first we're going to go to HB 156, but would you move the document for consideration? I'd appreciate it.
For 156?
For 156.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I move to have versions CSH be 156 29LS-0566-I to be our working document for consideration.
Okay, seeing no objection, that's the document in front of us for consideration. I won't ask now if somebody has a motion to move it. So, what I'd like to do is I'm going to make a presentation of the bill. It's my bill, Representative Keller, and then what I'll do here is I just would request that you let me go through the presentation and then direct your questions through the vice chair. I'm going to give her the gavel right now, and I'll just make the presentation from right here. I'd have a hard, but if I moved everything over there, then I'd be having to resort. So the gavel goes to the vice chair, and we all remember and have heard, and the terminology NCLB has been going around for a long time, No Child Left Behind, that introduced test-based education reform. And so most of our memories here, it seems like that's what education has been a major emphasis. But I have a question. Has test-based education reform worked? That's the question I want us to consider. What's going on? Has it been a successful move here? Has or can education reform effort that we've been focused on for over 15 years, or roughly 15 years now, a little less maybe, can it improve education, or has it improved education? We do have sufficient results for that. I think we have plenty of evidence. HB 156 is based on the premise that it is time to admit that we have made, I think, a mistake, and we spent an enormous amount of money and time on trying to reform education using the test-based theorem. It's time to stop it. It's time to stop the over-testing that is taking too much time in our schools and money to administrate. It's time to stop diverting time and priority as a priority and money from curriculum and from instruction that's going into the schools testing. It's time to stop the narrowing of the curriculum that it's happening. It's to enforce the alignment with the standardized tests that are out there. It's time to stop the teaching to the test mode that all of us resent. And it's a time to stop the unhealthy time that's being spent in, I'm going to say cramming, but getting ready for the tests. I first personally became aware of the test-based education reform thoughts not long after accepting a job working for Senator Dyson in 1999. I'm a teacher. My own teacher education was completed in 1983, and it, believe me, it had no inkling of the concept of test-based reform. To me, a test I was taught as a tool, a teaching tool, to find out where the child was beginning and where they ended and whatever. So this is new after I got my training. Test-based reform was enshrined in 2002 when NCLB passed. And NCLB, as you all know, and I'll use acronyms here because I know the committee is well aware of what they mean. The NCLB was a reenactment of ESEA, the Elementary Secondary Education Act of 1965. And, you know, when this happened, it was to address a very real problem. And frankly, it's a problem that still exists. And that is that there's gaps in our making education accessible. And the concern was that, hey, a lot of our poor communities, poor kids, are just not getting served with education. And the question that I have asked is, you know, has this test-based education reform worked? And I would contend that it's really not much different than it was when all this started. It all was very attractive, and I think for myself, I remember thinking, well, you know, that, hey, maybe this is the way we have to go, is to focus on the test. I remember hearing the mantra, you can't manage what you can't measure. That was the thought that was out there. And so the emphasis got on measuring what the students were doing. In 2001, the Alaska legislature declared a strong support for NCLB, but that support was conditional. It was very conditional. And the condition was that the consideration be made for Alaska, its uniqueness, its huge geographic area, and, you know, and again, the same idea is that the advantages to the students is the same all over. And I would again ask the question, has it worked? You know, has this happened? In 2001, when the that was HJR 13, if you want to go back and look at it, it's a very interesting document, HJR 13. At that time, there were 134,358 students. And just to give it a context, the next year when this passed, the third graders at the time were the first ones to be exposed to the new idea. Those kids are now 21 years old. You know, so we have seen a whole group of students come through under the premises that were introduced with the test-based education reform process. They were the first ones to get the to begin to be exposed to what has become the high-stakes test. I think the federal government entrusted these children, these Alaskans, to the unproven and ambitious belief that if we just test them and then hold the teachers responsible for improving the test scores, then almost all of them would be proficient, and they gave a promise, 2014. By 2014, NCLB. By 2014, no child be left behind. And I think it's very, very clear that the promise and the goal, it hasn't worked. And I propose with HB 156 that it's time to rethink it and to just consider the whole thing. And I'll go over the bill exactly, all the changes here in a little bit, but I want to say that it does two things, two primary things. And one is that it gives an immediate, it tells the state school board to come up with a process and the regulations, a policy for parents to be able to opt out of high-stakes testing. I think that that is overdue, and I think that, frankly, I believe that it's a constitutional right of a parent or a student to say no to that kind of thing. And, of course, the question comes then, are they eligible for the state resources that we're putting forward? And that's, you know, an open question. But I do think that we need to have the opt-out option going in there. The second thing that HB 156 does is that it eliminates basically all high-stake tests within 3 years, unless there's new legislation and a new process that specifically reauthorizes the Alaska testing system that is in place, in our existing laws. And just it's a kind of like something to drive a reconsideration of where we're at with our testing program. HB 156 acknowledges and makes allowance for the concerns of the fear of consequences that I'm sure we all have. By sunsetting the mandated tests as opposed to immediate repeal, it puts the it kind of puts it off as far as the day of reckoning on figuring this thing out. I'm told that if we were just to repeal all the tests, you know, and say, okay, we're not going to comply any further with NCLB, that'd be against federal law. And, you know, not appropriate, I don't think, by any of our standards. But this just says, hey, we want to be in that process, And so therefore, and by the way, yeah, the courts have told us that we have to be in this process. So we need to reconsider what these tests are, what we're doing with them, and ask ourselves the question, has the test-based education reform worked that we're at so far? The premise of NCLB was honorable, is honorable, and stands. And assuming that honorable intent, that certainly leaves room for the negotiation, renegotiation of how we're doing business in compliance with federal law. Two administrators pushed the concept of test-based reform, and one, of course, was Bush, and the other was Obama, and it's been ongoing, and it's something that we have to deal with, I think, now. The fact that 2014 has come, and I believe NCLB has demonstrated to be an ineffective solution to a very real problem, it would suggest that there's time to renegotiate this deal. The money that's available, made available to the state, and I'm told you can confirm this with EED, they're here to testify, I'm told that it's $69 million a year. But they will tell you, I think, in fact, the memos I've seen that have come from the U.S. Department of Education, is that this is not an on-off switch. In other words, with this bill, I believe, would in no way cause the federal government to just throw the switch and say no more money going to Alaska. But I also believe that that it's time, like I say, and the option is there to renegotiate on an issue-by-issue, item-by-item basis. The time to act is right now. If we don't put some firm resistance out there, and I know the Education Committee keeps track of the news, and you see other states and that, and there's a lot of pressure on this right now, but I think that's appropriate. We need to be able to vet the concerns and the issues of our teachers, our superintendents, and our kids, just be involved. I mean, whether or not, you know, we have no choice, really. Consider the fact that teacher evaluation, just a perfect example. Right now, in regulation, when our teachers are evaluated, there's a process that's coming into being that will begin to evaluate these teachers based on the test results of these kids. Now, whether that's right or wrong, no matter where you fall on that issue, I think everybody here would admit that that probably should be part of the process that happens in the state legislature, not just us accepting the calls from very frustrated teachers and saying, well, yeah, that's federal law. And so another one in the news release that came from DOE a couple of years ago, actually, there was a comment that they're going to make teacher or the test-based reform process be part of the teacher training process. In other words, they're going to make tests, high-stake tests, to qualify teachers. That was from February 7th, 2015. And the pattern with these things is we read about it in the press like that. We read articles about it, reactions to it, whatever. And then pretty soon it shows up in our law, and again we've had, or not our regulations actually, and we have had nothing to say about it. In summary, it's way past time to do something. And what this bill does, the most dramatic thing I think it does, is it deletes this much. That's ESEA, and that's before NCLB. There's actually another 300 pages you can add to that. And what we've done is, in this bill, you'll find it, I'll go over it item by item and show you, but there's two sections. One is that says very clearly that we have to implement this, and another one is that we have to conform to it. So this, I'm going to pass out the section of law that this primarily introduces, or addresses, I should say, and it's 123, 1403-123, and it's one page. but it's one page plus this. So what the bill does is it just simply takes this out. Okay, now does that negate, does that say that we're annulling what the feds are doing? Not at all. The federal law exists and stands. It doesn't matter what we do in state law. And I think you'll get testimony from the department and the Department of Law that, that taking this out does not, in and of itself, any kind of defiance, legal defiance here. There's 1,291 pages there that have been added. And I think that, oh, by the way, just that bill, there's another, because of the fact that we are held responsible to oversee public education in the state of Alaska, there's another factor. I mean, it's not just the 1,291 pages. You've got the waivers, and you've got the agreements and that happen not because they want to leave us out, but just that we're not part of the process. So your support on this bill will be appreciated. I have no intention of asking that we move this bill today. I think it's going to be a work in progress. And but I probably right after Easter in that week, I'm going to ask for a vote. And in that time period, as I go through the item by item in the bill, I think there'll be some things in there that you may want to look at and help me consider. The real issue is whether or not we can comply actually with the court mandate that we're supposed to oversee public education. I have somewhere here I have a one-page press release from the, it's called the Council of Great Urban Schools, I think it is, and I think Anchorage is a member of that. But there's a comment in this press release, I'll get you a copy of it here when I get my hands on it, that just shows what we're up against. And the quote is, quote, the council urges the states to apply for the new waivers, NCLB waivers, and work with their districts on those applications. If the states are reluctant to proceed, urban districts should initiate their own applications. So it's an appeal by an organization to our school districts to work directly with the federal government instead of if the state, you know, Department of Ed or legislature doesn't engage. So it just illustrates, I think, what we're up against. So at this time, what I'd like to do is go over the bill with you. And here is a copy of that if you want to pass it around there. And again, it's version I. What I'm going to do is just thumb through here quick and give you an idea of what's in the bill, because there's a few things other than the two main things. The two main things, again, are to give an opt-out process for our kids on these high stakes tests. And the second thing is to go ahead and mandate the elimination of those tests pending action and approval by the legislature and a vetting process. When you go to page one there of the bill in version India on the CS, the only change there, there's nothing on page one. If you go to page two, item five down to line seven, by the way, we just got a fiscal note on this, and there's a comment in the fiscal note that makes me realize that my wording may not be well, but I want to put my intent down there and ask the committee and the department to help me reword it if that's what it takes. But the addition is the methodology used to assign the state public school system a performance designation that compares the state public school system to public schools in other states and nations. If you go back, that paper I just handed out to you on the 123 of the law, if you go up to Section A, you'll see very specifically there in the sentence that it's already law that the department is to assign these public school system a grade or a give us some kind of idea what's going on. But what was missing is a requirement that they report the methodology for getting that done. I don't think anything new is needed there. There's a very good information out there comparing how we're doing, and it's very old and it's trustworthy, and that is the NAEP. NAEP evaluates all the states and then gives us a rating of our proficiency of our kids and gives us a comparison with the other states. And I didn't want to put in there that that the methodology should be NAEP, you know, because I figured, well, that's too narrow. I want to give the department the option here of using whatever metric they want to use to be able to give us that grade, you know, to rate our state against the other systems. Backing up, I missed probably the most dramatic part there. If you look at page 2 again, up in lines 3 and 4, and then down on lines 29 and 30, that's where we have deleted the reference to the implementation or the conforming to the federal law. And you'll see it does not delete our accountability system. Our state accountability system still stands. It just deletes the references to the federal law. If you go down to section 2 of the bill, this section addresses the low performance designation for students. All it does is down on lines 17 through 20 is it says that there's an improvement plan that is there for a low performing performance designation in school. It just says that the improvement plan must give preference to measures that increase local control of education and parental choice that do not require a direct increase of funding to the school district. So it's just emphasizing that when a school is in trouble, it doesn't presume that the local community cares and that the parents care, but it says, hey, if they do, they and you have that's part of the plan. That has to be given preference, and I think that is very legitimate, especially for our rural schools to have that kind of input. Section 3 of the bill this is a different category school. This is the ones that are doing very well. We have a mandate there that the department has to establish special recognition. And the way it was written is it was special recognition to high-performing schools, and the district or the department has included the improvement element, if you remember, on in evaluating these schools, and I think that's excellent. But what this does is goes one step further. It says that the ones that should really get the improvement are the ones, or the high recognition and special recognition, are those that are constantly improving. So what it does is it removes the cap, because the cap is high, right? The cap is those that are the high performing schools. Well, high isn't defined, you know, and it depends on who is making the evaluation. This just says, hey, if a school is in continual improvement, they deserve high recognition. And it takes the lid off, you know, so that way there's not a bar, you know, it's on some testing or accountability system that you get to and then you're okay, you can relax, you know. It said, hey, if you want high recognition, press on here. Okay, then you go on to section 5 on page 3 there, and this is the section between lines 9 and line 18, and this is a new subsection, so it's one that you want to pay particular attention to. It has two elements. The one I already mentioned is that it requires an opt-out segment for parents and students. And number two is that the data that is collected on these students is safe, secure, and legitimately protected, so that we know that it's not personally identifiable and used for the benefits local for the kids. Now, that particular section, and I'm talking here about page 3, sections 14 through 18, I would like your that's part of the reason why we're not moving the bill today, is I would like the committee consideration on whether or not that should be strengthened. There's another bill that has been requested for hearing from Representative Reinbold that is on data security, and you know, yeah, I'll kind of poll the committee to see what you're thinking on that, but we can get a presentation on that bill and then consider folding in the elements that we want to into this subparagraph. Get on to section 6 there on page 3, starting at lines 19 through page 4, line 9. And I just saw this for the first time this morning. In final form, we've been working on it. And what it is the process for stopping the high-stake tests unless there's been a process in the legislature that includes a school district that goes back and vets the issues. The working language there is on page 4, line 8 and 9. You know, if after consideration and maybe new legislation being presented and whatever, in the following session anyway, the standard-based and standard-based assessments or teacher performance standards on which the legislature failed to act are approved. So in other words, if we don't act and there's something that comes forward that from the department and the school districts and we fail to act, then it automatically becomes law. Whether that's an appropriate trigger or not, I'm going to let the committee work on that one. I'm a little uncomfortable with it myself, but that's the language that's before you, and I wanted to call your attention to it. And then starting on section 4, or page 4 there, section 7, the entire section, that's all existing language. All it does is a cleanup there on the last page, on page 6, line 10, where it makes a reference to a new subsection because we deleted the one on deleting the federal language. With that, I'm going to stop and ask for questions, and then what I'm going to do is ask your questions to go through the vice chair. She has the gavel, and that way I won't talk too much. She'll give preference to you and your questions. So I'm here for questions.
Representative Culver.
Thank you. First of all, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for bringing this before us. I think this is groundbreaking. I like where we delete the reference to conforming with federal law and take out the phone book out of our statutes as a good start. The area there's been a lot of trepidation, I think, that we've heard the last year is the new process for teacher evaluations and developing performance standards, because we don't really have a cookbook for that process. It's kind of in draft form and it hasn't been tested yet. So on page 3 of the bill, section 6, and you just discussed that as far as the legislature could then not act to repeal standards and process as developed by the department through the State Board of Education. Would this abate? My question is, would this hold in abeyance the current process until we get a better formula, one that's better vetted and the districts have had an opportunity to participate in the teacher evaluation process?
Representative Culver, through the vice chair.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, it would not. The existing regs that are in place would continue, and as I understand it, you might want to ask the department when they get here, it's a system that they are phasing in. So, and I don't know the timeline and whatever. So that's I have not directly addressed that issue. And my thinking on it was that, from my perspective, I anyway don't really know what is appropriate. You know, and I think that that's because we haven't vetted the issue. I put a lot of value in us, you know, hammering that out. So if you want to hammer that out in this bill, then you can consider amending whatever.
Yeah, perhaps it would be good to hear from the department their thoughts on that, just as a follow-up, Madam Chair. I would maybe suggest that might be a possible consideration by the committee that we put in a section that we put on hold the existing evaluation process till we have one that's more thoroughly vetted and involves more stakeholder involvement as a possibility, because I know it's this big dark cloud hanging over a lot of educators, and you know, we're kind of moving away from condemnation of schools, calling them failing schools under NCLB when we're looking at this type of reform. And I like what you said in there about more local control, and that seems to be the intent of the ordinance. Parental control, local control, getting back control of our education process, peeling back federal control as much as possible.
Any other Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the sponsor, I guess I'm trying to figure out, I remember there was a strong debate and on bill in the previous, brought forward by the previous administration, and we were looking at teacher evaluations at 50% or one-third, 30% evaluation. Legislature seemed to have acted on that with the department. So are we revisiting that issue of teacher evaluations here? Because as I remember, a number of people were very strongly committed to a much higher percentage of the teacher evaluation being related to the performance of their students. And what I am understanding here is we want to take that away so that we're put in abeyance the teacher accountability. Basically, I'm not sure what form that would come forward in if we didn't have the system that the legislature considered, in previous legislature considered.
Representative Seaton, through the chair. I personally do not remember that interaction happening. I don't remember the bill. And I will say that I was not on the Education Committee at that time, and I would defer to your remembering. But I want to say that my point for bringing that up is that it is a issue that is being driven from above. It's coming top down through the federal government, and we need to understand that we have some options within that 1,291 pages, you know, that we may not have realized. And yes, so my hope would be that we'd reevaluate that issue and others that.
Yes, Representative Seaton.
Thanks. Over the last several years, of course, I think it might have involved the lawsuit as well, but the legislature dealt with the idea of low-performing schools and taking over having an improvement plan, because the local districts, who have, of course, the full control of their curriculum and plans of development, were what were called failing schools by Alaska standards. So if we go back to the system of saying that local districts will have all control of curriculum, even if they are underperforming or in very poor performance, does this take us back to that system? I'm unsure as to how I'm reading it for the first time here.
Yeah, sure. Representative Seaton, through the chair. It does not. It leaves the existing system in place. And I think what you're referring to is that if we violated the waivers that are in place to NCLB, then there's a possibility that we would go back to the NCLB as we just deleted, or, you know, if we go through with this bill. Under that system, under the NCLB, then I think we'd be back to the old designators and the and all the criteria. But I think that HB 156, as you have it in front of you, does not change that. It just kind of opens the door for reconsideration on that.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for the bill sponsor. I've got a couple as I go through this. Yes. In section 2 of the CS, the added language to AS 14.03.123, I was curious if the sponsored specific ideas of measures that an improvement plan might incorporate that represent local control of education and parental choice. And I was also hoping the sponsor could speak to what seems, at least on its face, slightly contradictory, in that if we're encouraging local control of education. It seems we wouldn't want to prescribe any measures to the local districts for how they would improve. But in the same sentence of emphasizing local control of education, we're also prescribing from the top or from the state parental choice as a measure that would help school districts improve that are trying to embrace local control, even if they may or may not embrace that idea.
Representative Christ Tompkins through the chair. The way this is written is that the department would have to give preference, you know, the idea is if they saw it as, you know, appropriate, because, the EED's duties and responsibilities do not change in this. It's just saying, hey, pay attention to the local district, what they want. In the case you bring up on mentors, let's say there was a community that violently did not like the idea of having mentors in their community, whatever. I would think that that's something that would have to be dealt with, you know, by the department, by, you know, the community, and just worked on. And I think that this would, in this language in there, would indicate that if a community was really against having mentors in their community, that they would have to, you know, consider that as a primary factor in working with the plan. Remember, this is to put together a plan for improvement of local schools. For one thing, I guess, if I, just envisioning a make-believe situation, if I was in a community that, in such a situation as this, I can't imagine trying to make an argument that getting rid of mentors to help our teachers would be part of an improvement plan. In other words, I think it might be something that in reality wouldn't happen. You know, I think that by and large, mentors are well received. I haven't heard of anything negative, whatever. But it just, all it does is put emphasis on the fact that if you have a low-performing school, hey, talk to the parents. Hey, talk to the local school board members. Hey, talk to the community and see what's going on and see what they think is needed for the improvement. Madam Vice Chair,
yes,
a comment on that, if I could, that really kind of builds on yours. The real failure here of the test-based reform project is that we have not stepped forward with the resources that would really be needed, you know, to address some of the issues that are in the local community. That I don't expect this bill to change that, you know, but I'm going to say that I don't believe the test-based reform effort has changed it. I think there's still, a shortage of the resources for the, for some of these local struggling communities. So.
Madam Vice Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Talking about the testing regime, I mean, currently we are, I'm trying to figure out, we are currently in revising the entire idea of testing so that it is not only computer-based, but it's analytical and concepts instead of regurgitation of facts. I mean, that's been, I think that you're appropriately addressing that. The testing regime, where it's regurgitation of facts, has proven to be not really good for engaging students and long-term learning. Does the change in testing, so that we're now going to testing based on analytics and analysis, does that reform of that regime make any difference, or are we just talking about all tests within the bill here?
Representative Seaton, through the Vice Chair, I think where the problem is, personally, is that we have made the results of the test be so high stakes, and by it's like a fetish, you know, where that's where everybody focuses is on getting a score, on the test. So. It isn't so much whether it's computer-based or not, and I think the computer-based element of the testing does enable us to do that, you know, a lot more easily than a paper-based system. And I'm questioning the whole process of making the test base element the lever to try to force a better education system. That's what we started out with here in 2002 with NCLB. And what I'm calling into question is the whole concept, the whole philosophy of doing that. You know, and there are other options. And by the way, I'm not the only one. I'm not doing this in a vacuum. You know, there's I give you a list of respectful entities. I can do that real quickly here if you like, that have called into question whether or not the high stakes element, you know, has really helped us in this education reform process.
Representative Culver.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Mr. Chairman, I think you just hit on the most important part, that this is, I think we can make an hypothesis that this is a failed experiment, and that has it increased student learning substantially with the amount of resources. It's driving education. It's driving curriculum. It's driving resources, this testing. And I would submit that if we talk to educators in the trenches, they would feel very stressed by the fact that this testing, how it's driving, and they can't get the time to teach what they want to teach the kids. And so that's part of this loss of local control. I would like to get some feedback from the district. Well, what would you do if we didn't have these standards? What would your learning plans look like? What would your curriculum look like? How would you approach this? But I want to loop back to what we were talking about, local control and how that would play out. And there was a question a little bit ago. And it made me think about a standardized test that we no longer do, the high school exit exam. And I remember a few years ago when every few years the bill would come up to repeal the exit exam. And the testimony came from administrators and students from CHEVAC, and they testified before the Senate Education Committee that their kids were at a disadvantage because there was questions asked on the standardized test. For instance, how do you get to the hospital? And the kids, the answer to them was an airplane. Well, the correct answer on the standardized test was an ambulance. So I think that's where we segue into local control. Local control, as it means to a community in Alaska, and the norm that you need for education and survival may be much different than a nationalized standard test. And so it might be subsistence, it might be survival, it might be learning about things like how the Native Land Claims Act came to happen in Alaska, and more about culture. There's a lot of things that probably ought to be taught that are being pushed out because we have to prepare for these standard assessments. And now the districts are under pressure because the teacher evaluations are going to be generated off of the results of these tests. So that is what's driving education in this state. And I think that this bill is a refreshing look at, is it working? Is it not working? And how can we do better with providing more control locally? And put some of these tests under scrutiny. So I guess my purpose of this statement was that how local control could work to have more cultural sensitivity, and that each specific area of Alaska is different. Thank you.
Representative Price Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Vice Chair, let's see, a couple other sectional questions. Let's see. On page 2, I was hoping the sponsor could speak to the intent of the language in section 1, lines 7 through 9, a methodology assigning state public school systems a performance designation. My interpretation in reading that is that that would compare the Alaska Department of Education against other similar departments of education around the country. I want to make sure that that interpretation is accurate or what the sponsor had in mind.
Representative Chris Thompson, through the chair. No, that is not my intent. The school system, is, as I see it, is our, how we're doing overall. In other words, you take a look at our public, look at the law that I passed out, if I can find my copy here real quick. The law itself, 123, section A, which is not in the bill. Please, everybody look at that, and that might clarify that section a little bit. If you have it, if somebody would read A. I don't have it. It was a one piece, one pager that I passed out. Somebody have it? There, thanks. Okay, read it in. In section A of 1403.123, by September 1st of each year, the department shall assign a performance designation to each public school, one, and school district, two, and the state public school system. So the reference on page 2 of the bill, lines 7 to 9, it goes back to that that one element, and that is the public school system. And the intent of the author, again, was to just identify how the department would give the school system a grade. And if I were to do it, and I realize that I don't have the expertise or the you know, the broad scope of understanding what's out there, if I were to give us a grade, I would go to NAEP, N-A-E-P. And if you go online, you'll find out there are international comparisons out there. You know, I mean, I don't know enough to say, to know whether or not the international ones are valid, appropriate, credible. That's something that, that's why it's written the way it is identify the methodology used in assigning the state public school system, that's the operating words, the state public school system, a performance designation that compares the state to other states and countries. So I my first inclination was to write that they use NAEP, you know, N-A-E-P, because that test, it has real, what do I want to say, weaknesses in that it doesn't go to every child in the state of Alaska. They use a sampling method, as the department has told us. They sample probably about half of the students and give them the test. And that gives us a proficiency, a rating on how they're doing in reading, writing, and arithmetic in the schools. They do this in all the states. It's been around for decades and decades. And it's a reference point that I use. But I didn't want to put in the bill that they have to use NAEP. I wanted to know the methodology they use, because NAEP will be there no matter what we do with this bill, and we can all reference that. But if there's a better criteria for that comparison, then identify it is the point of this section. So.
Yes, you may proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Will the removal of the reference to the section of federal statute that you mentioned in section 4 jeopardize or imperil Alaska's waiver to NCLB, and if so, are there ramifications in terms of loss of federal funding that you're aware of?
Representative Christ Tompkins, through the chair, that question would be better be asked to the Department of Education, but from my evaluation, my understanding, it will not. For one thing, I went back and looked at, you know, this, how to get here. if I might a little bit expand again on Representative Christ Tompkins. I went back and looked at the history. My question was, how in the world did that get in the law in the first place? And I was chagrined to find out that I didn't vote on it, but I was here. In fact, I spoke to the bill. And I have to confess, I've had a change of heart in this whole process, because I'm very frustrated with the constant evidences that we get on the low performance of our schools. And my tendency was, yeah, well, let's get the data and be able to evaluate these schools and, you know, either punish or reward or something to make it happen. So, but anyway, all that is a roundabout way to answer your question. There is, on the record back then when this bill passed, the Neil Schlotnick from the Department of Law went online, and he said there's nothing in the NCLB that requires it to be encoded into state law.
Mm. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the sponsor, I'm trying to understand on page 2, the lines 7 through 9, the performance for the school system. And what I'm understanding is you're saying that the preference is that we use the student performance, comparative student performance on a test to rate the different school systems. Is that correct?
Representative Seaton, through the Vice Chair. NAEP is not a high-stakes test. NAEP is a data collecting on the school system in general. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we went to the high-stake testing beyond NAEP, because you cannot identify and track students in schools with NAEP. NAEP gives a general overall evaluation of how the state is doing on proficiency. So the answer to your question is yes, but it's not fair to say that we're using a high-stakes test to get rid of the high-stake test. It's not apples to apples. And I might also point out that we have on the record that NAEP costs us $0. It definitely costs us time. You know, when they come in and give our students testing on NAEP, it does. We are invested because teachers have to take the time to administrate the test. So.
Representative Keller, for the record, can you please spell out the acronym NAEP?
Yes, N-A-E-P.
And do you recall what that stands for?
I was afraid you were going to ask that. Let's ask the department when they get here, but it's something evaluation. I don't know. Okay.
Representative Keller, for the record, how do you define high-stakes testing that's been used quite often this morning?
Representative Vasquez, I define it personally as that where the failure has consequences that are significant beyond just the awareness that there's a lack of knowledge. In other words, you may not graduate, you may not get a raise, you may not, you know, it's a high stakes in the sense that we got to get this passed or we're going to lose federal funding, that kind of thing.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Yes.
National Association of Educational Procurement.
Thank you. And when
no.
was
the no, no. no. Let me repeat. Assessment.
Assessment of educational program.
I was reading the wrong line.
Representative Keller, and do you recall when was the last time that test was used by the state of Alaska?
Madam Chair, what the NAEP?
Yes.
That's an annual event, I believe, but again, as far as details on that, you know, the department would be able to give it to us. But I think that's an ongoing, I know it was there in the 80s. I don't really know when it started, but it was there. That was under the original ESEA. NAEP was definitely in operation and still is.
Okay. But it's no longer used in the state of Alaska?
Oh, no, I'm sorry if I implied that. No, it's ongoing and used, and you can go online and get the NAEP scores, and that is the basis for comparing our state with other states right now.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? I have a question. Is there a mechanism, can you use NAEP not on a sample basis, provided to each student. For example, a parent may actually want to know what the performance level of their child is whenever these tests are administered, and not assume that their own child is doing well compared to the state, compared to the national level.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding, and I'll be corrected if I'm wrong, but that is not an option for NAEP. You cannot go back and get individual information. But the second half of a response to your question is that does not mean, again, this bill does not mean that we quit tracking our students with tests. It does not imply that. It does not do that. As a teacher, I learned very early on, you know, that if you're going to teach a group of children that you hadn't met, you know, or adults, doesn't make any difference, the very first thing you have to do as a teacher is find out what they know, you know, and so you give them a test. I mean, that's what you do. And then that gives you an idea of what's known and what's not known. And then when you're done with the class, you give another test, you know, and that test is to see, well, okay, did I succeed in my efforts here or did I not? So this is a reaction against the high stakes part. It's not a reaction against testing to track our students locally, at home, and in the state. And as long as that tracking is done in a secure fashion so that the data is not mined and used for other purposes, et cetera. You know, so.
Any other questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. For the sponsor, I guess on page 3 in section 5, lines 11 through 13. So in there, then, we're not giving the parent or the guardian of a student the ability to opt out of assessment. There's only a certain assessment that we're allowing them to opt out of, and this doesn't give them the ability to opt out of that end of course or end of school test.
The terminology used here, Representative Seaton, through the chair, is they have the option to opt out of an assessment used to implement the accountability system under this section. Good question. I saw the CS this morning, and my intent is that the state accountability system stays in place until we reconsider, it is, if maybe we need to be more specific here about what can actually be opted out of, actually name the tests, you know, that may be appropriate. But no matter what the test is, even if the very informal, crude explanation I just gave on tests, that as a teacher I want to know where my students start and where they finish, again, it is the parent's option to not have the child participate if that's their, I say, constitutional right, and there's no penalty that can be placed on them, and they have the option to not be there and to not take tests. You know, I mean, that's just a human basic right, I think, that we are talking about here, but that has to be defined a little bit better, because the requirement we put on the district is different than the freedom that we give the parent. In other words, if we tell the district, okay, you have to give a test to every student in order to figure out where they're going, you know, and to track them, that's one thing. To tell the parent, you have to take the test and you have to force your child to take that test, we'll never go there. Because it's fundamentally, we just can't, you know. So.
Representative
Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the sponsor, I'm somewhat confused. The text of the law, of the proposed law, says that students may opt out of any student assessment, but in your explanation just now, opt out of any student assessment used to implement the accountability system under this section, but you just said that a parent may opt a student out of any test, including that which the teacher gives at every step of the process in their classroom. How is a teacher supposed to know if the students are making progress, if they're going to get opted out of every test that the parent chooses to opt them out of?
Representative Tremblant.
Yes, you may proceed.
Yeah, a good question. I probably was fuzzy on what I meant. What I meant by it, I was thinking of the broader sense of opt-out. A parent has the right to have the student there or not, you know. But when we're talking high-stake tests, that's what the this. My intent was that the state school board comes up with a process to allow the students to opt out. In other states right now, parents are voting with their feet. They're just not sending their kids, and there's no reason why not. We can't ask our state board of education to come up with a process for that opt-out. So when I said that it's a parent's right, I was thinking in the most basic and fundamental sense. You know, I have a right, anybody has a right, to not send their child to a public school system, but they don't get the benefits, you know. So at that level is the fundamental right. And then somewhere in between, you know, we have to deal with these mandatory high-stake tests. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to get a system for opting out of the high-stake tests.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess as the discussion goes on, I'd like the sponsor to bring forward the high-stakes tests that are given in the state of Alaska, because I'm unaware, since we got rid of the exit exam, of what high-stakes tests, other than there was a bill that put a graduation requirement, which is a high-stakes test, on the passage of a constitutionalism element. But other than that, there are no other high-stakes graduation requirements that I'm aware of in the state other than passing all of your the required number of credits and courses to graduate from high school.
Representative Seaton, through the chair. If you ask the teachers in the state of Alaska right now, they would tell you AMP, MAP is taking up all their time. It's a very, very frustrating, not all their time. That was an overstatement. It's using a lot of their time, class time, that could be used, you know, for curriculum and instruction. So your request for a list is something that can be provided, but I think it's very clear to the parents out there right now, the teachers and the principals that are dealing with having to perform these tests that came to us ultimately through a top-down process, NCLB and the waivers.
Mr. Keller, Representative Keller, you used several acronyms. Can you spell them out for the record, please?
If I can remember what acronyms they were. Oh, AMP, MAP. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. It's the but what it is the tests that are required by the state accountability system right now, grades 3 through 10, as motivated by NCLB. NCLB actually requires testing 3 to 8, and then once in high school, I think. But we, in the state of Alaska, our accountability system has 3 through 10, and we have the two tests, and the acronyms are AMP and MAP. But again, I need help from our assessment people to come up with what the actual words are.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Madam Chair, I was not asking what tests are being required to be taken. I was talking about the designation of a high-stakes test, meaning if you don't get a certain cut score, you don't, or if you don't complete that, then you don't pass. So if we're using high-stakes in a different terminology than like an exit exam or like passing the bar exam or those being high-stakes tests, if we're using that in a different context, I just want to know what context we use that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Seaton. The high-stake tests are terms I've been throwing around and here in discussion. They're very much high stakes in the sense that if we don't do them, we've been told very clearly that we have $69 million federal dollars at stake if we do not comply and give. That's high stakes for us, you know, for our state. Our revenue stream is at stake. And yes, from your, I understand your question. You were saying, you know, I define, maybe I did, high stakes in the sense of the student. But there's other senses that it can be high stakes.
Any other questions? Okay. We have two individuals on the line that wish to testify. Mr. David Neese, are you on the line?
Yeah, this is David Neese representing myself. First of all, I'd like to say thank you, Representative Keller, for bringing this forward. I think it is a good time to examine our relationship between ourselves and the Department of Education. I would like to...
Excuse me, Mr. Neese. For the record, can you please spell your name and your affiliation, if any, please?
David Neese, D-A-V-I-D-N-E-E-F. Affiliation, I am myself. Testifying in favor of the bill, I would like to congratulate Representative Keller on having brought this forward. It is time to take a look at our relationship between our state of Alaska education system and the federal government. I was there when NCLB came in. We all said it was impossible for us to get everybody on track by 2014. We were correct. And if the state had listened to the teachers back then, we probably would not be having this discussion. I would like to add that the NAEP is an excellent test, but I would also encourage the committee to take a look at the test of adult basic school education, the TABE test. It costs about $1.25 to administer. It requires a pencil and about 20 minutes. And it is very, very accurate. It is what all of the GED centers use to figure out where children are behind. There is nothing incorrect state law that mandates the Department of Education do any intervention on children that are not doing well. And that is probably one of the things that is missing, is assigning the responsibility for intervention on children's education when they are falling behind. So thank you very much for bringing this bill forward. It will be interesting to follow us, Barbara.
Thank you, Mr. Neese. Do we have a Barbara Haney on the line?
Hi, my name is Barbara Haney, and I'm calling in. I guess represent myself.
Ms. Haney.
I want to open.
Ms. Haney. Ms. Haney.
Yes, ma'am.
For
yes,
the record, ma'am. Please spell your name and disclose any affiliation you may have.
Okay, B A R B A R A H A N E Y.
Thank you.
I'm calling in as myself. I do have a webpage called Alaskans Against Common Core, but I'm calling in on my own behest, as others may or may not. I wanted to open with just a couple comments. One, Representative Vasquez, you asked about the NAEP test. It was just given in Houston, I believe, recently. So it is a test that's being given. And in the context of the high stakes test, I think anytime you have district funding and accountability tied to testing, it is high stakes. Whether it's high stakes for the student or the district or the state is perhaps an issue, but it's still a high stakes test. Couple of things I wanted to address. One is there was a comment by Representative Culber about what local control looks like. I would encourage you to look at Mary Janice's statement at the Lunch and Learn on the 15th of February, 2015. In that presentation, Mary Janice talked about her own upbringing in the state of Alaska, and that was under the 70s and 80s when there was absolute local control. I'd also like to remind the committee that the Statehood Organization Act, Section 14, made it very clear that the Alaska Department of Education would have no control over matters of curriculum in the organized districts, and that right was extended to the Rural Education Areas, or REAs, on January 1st, 1976. It has only been since maybe 2005-2006 that DEETS has been allowed to intervene in areas of curriculum and testing with the local districts. I applaud this bill, but there's a couple things I would like to point out. Number one, parents currently do have the right to refuse the test, and that's in the Department of Education's own documents, and I would refer people specifically to page 112 of the district test manual. I would hope that the committee would get at the issue of adaptive testing as well. One of the things that happened before this current test was adopted was that they got rid of the legislation on norms testing so that adaptive testing could be implemented. The second thing I would note is that testing should sunset at the end of 2016-2017, and I believe that the new ESA, or whatever they reauthorize, will probably be known by that time. So that would make that sunset with this and the sunset with federal legislation dovetail nicely. The other thing I would hope is that any in the methodology section of the bill, that if you do use NAEP, you also consider the TIMS, which is the time in which is the test comparing math and science skills. And I would also hope that any researchers would take into consideration the problems that were on the 2000 NAEP, NAEP test, because that those computer errors were so bad that that can't be used by researchers for benchmarking. The other thing I would hope that people would consider is that there should be some kind of index of freedom and political considerations and sampling size in making those comparisons. So to compare Alaska to, say, for example, a communist nation would be relatively unfair, particularly when they only have the top 1% of their nation taking that test. So I think those kind of considerations need to be made in making any kind of interstate or international comparisons. The third issue I want to get at is a body of literature that's out there on test scores or value-added measures. The Journal of the American Statistical Association and the American Statistical Society recently published a review of the value of student test scores in teacher quality and teacher variability. And they found that less than 1% of all of those were actually involved in teacher, it could be accounted for teacher variability. The other thing I would like to point out is that there are laws in the books right now on certain issues like spending money on Common Core, and that has really, the department has done almost nothing in that regard. They still are spending money on Common Core. If you take a look at MEH, they've got full-blown Common Core. They're bringing in Roger Bidey, who's the author of the Next Generation Standards in October, which is a pure Common Core curriculum. Laws don't seem to have much of an impact on the Department of Education unless it's going to be backed by some kind of sanctions or some other kind of action. So I hope the committee does give that some consideration. Last, I know there's a lot of concern about the Moore decision. I'm not sure that Judge Gleason understood that one of the witnesses, Linda Darling Hammond, had skin in the game and had a testing company. And I think if something like that ever comes up again, perhaps the Department of Education might look at a broader range of witnesses that they could bring in to counter those kind of lawsuits in the future. Generally speaking, I'm supportive of the bill, but I'm hoping that we can get something with some real teeth in there that will really end federal involvement and really give back to the state the local control that was given to us in the Statehood Organization Act. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Haney. Well, I invite Dee to work with the sponsor in this legislation and will set the bill aside for future committee consideration. A brief at ease.
If we could go to the next bill, HB 163, the sponsor would come forward. Yeah. And just for the committee consideration, I'm willing to pass the bill out today if you're so inclined. So if you have any concerns on and do not want that to happen, be articulate. We'll let you make the, what's this? Sweets, I see. And what we'll do is let the sponsor present the bill and introduce herself first, of course, for the record. And we'll hold off on our questions until you ask for them or you're done. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson. I represent District 3, North Pole. As you will see, we brought a few visuals for you today to have a little better understanding about the bill. The bill was actually brought to me by a school board member from Ketchikan. I didn't even know this existed until he came and visited with me. So with that, imagine your child wants to help raise funds for your school club by participating in the school bake sale. Your child wants to learn how to make grandma's famous cupcakes and cookies for the fundraiser. After hours of baking, you carefully wrap your child's proudly decorated baked goods ready for the bake sale tomorrow. The next morning, you head out with your excited child and walk proudly into the school with their treats, preferably this one. To your dismay, you are told that the time-honored tradition of homemade bake sale treats has now come under federal attack. The federal Smart Snack Standards outlined in Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010 requires all food sold during the school day to meet national nutrition standards, including all school fundraisers held during the school day. Okay, so if you have a football game on the weekend, you can still sell whatever kind of hot dogs and treats you want to before school, after school, but not during the school day. However, if it's a birthday party, they did make exemptions for that. We also found exemptions for something like Girl Scout cookies because it is said that if it's in a box, you're going to assume that the child is not going to eat it during the day. I do think that's probably a pretty big assumption. I know here at the Capitol, Girl Scout cookies don't last very long. So having overstepped its regulatory authority, the USDA has proposed a sweeping plan that would regulate the types of foods and beverages that could be marketed on school property during school hours. The resulting laws put the Department of Agriculture in the business of determining the amount of calories, fat, and sodium students should consume in a given school day. The Department of Agriculture Secretary is now telling schools the type of milk, vegetables, and grain that cannot be served in cafeterias. The law places greater federal control over wellness policies best left in the hands of local leaders and parents. The federal standards will severely cut into thousands of dollars schools raise to support school programs and activities. Currently, all Alaskan school fundraisers for PTAs, student groups, and sport teams are now limited to selling carrot sticks and rice cakes to generate revenue. Unless, another caveat in it, as you may see, you may not be able to see from there, the cookies probably don't have a whole lot of nutrition in them, but the others are banana, and we also have a blueberry muffin. But again, we would have to have the ingredients to know whether or not they are healthy enough to be sold at a fundraiser. We did want to do another experiment, but we didn't do it, Mr. Chair, of actually putting these on the table ahead of time to find out which one would have been chosen. So with that, student groups and sport teams are now limited to selling carrot sticks and rice cakes to generate revenue. Parents who wish to contribute homemade items to be sold during school hours must now have their family recipes reviewed to ensure federal compliance to nutritional standards. Forcing parents and school organizations to only offer federally approved food and snacks at fundraisers is a perfect example of federal overreach and intrusion into the time-honored tradition of a school bake sale. The Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010 requires that all food sold outside of the school meal programs on the school campus and any time during the school day must meet national nutrition standards. The Smart Snack Standards allows state governments flexibility for special exemptions for the purpose of conducting infrequent school-sponsored fundraisers during which foods do not meet the nutrition standards for Smart Snacks may be sold. State agencies may determine the frequency with which fundraising activities take place that allow the sale of food and beverage items that do not meet these standards. Alaska is one of 29 states that currently do not have a policy under the Smart Snack Standards. As a result, the state of Alaska has defaulted to zero exempt fundraisers. Thus, all school fundraisers during the school day in Alaska must meet the strict nutrition standards as set by the federal government. It's the purpose of HB 163 to require the Department of Education and Early Development to adopt regulations authorizing schools to approve fundraisers involving the sale of foods that do not meet the food nutrition standards. And with that, Mr. Chair, that is what our bill does. I would just like to bring to your attention just a couple things. First of all, if you notice in the title of our bill, it talks about health and social services, and that was a mistake that was made, and if you'd like to pass the bill out today, I would ask for a friendly amendment to remove that out of the title. This is all based in the Department of Education, not the Department of Health and Social Services. I also would like to bring to your attention, we actually wanted the bill to be where there were no restrictions. I truly believe that this is something that should be in the hands of our local school districts to determine what kind of fundraisers they want to have during the school day. However, if we want to follow federal guidelines, it has to do with the reduced and free lunch, and that's what this comes from, then to follow state law would be to at least require the department to allow these fundraisers to be held during the school day. So with that, I'll take any questions you may have, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity.
Questions from the committee? I'll answer your question first. It's not in the section of federal code that we're trying to delete in another bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What can you explain in the title there? You're suggesting the elimination of the terminology relating to the duties of the Department of Health and Social Services. Are you saying they have no duties, under this code?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's exactly right. This was an error that was done by legal. They brought that to our attention, but since we were already before you, we figured if there was any other changes that we would just do that. But no, this has nothing to do with health and social services. All falls underneath the Department of Education.
And for the information of the committee, we have Diane Peck here from the Department of Health and Social Services to answer any questions related to that. Okay, any questions for the sponsor from the committee?
Does this have any effect on school funding from the federal government, this proposed change?
Representative Beth Kess, through the chair, if we change it to where, as the bill is written right now, to the regulations would be for infrequent fundraisers, no, it would have no impact. If the bill were to be changed to allow it up to the districts to have as many as they wanted to, then it would, from my understanding. It could impact how the monies come in from the federal programs. But as the bill is written, no, because this would follow the infrequency of that to be determined by the Department of Education.
Representative Vasquez?
Okay. Yeah. So the frequency is not explicitly set forth in the bill, but you expect DEED or the Department of Education Early Development to issue implementing regulations?
Representative Vasquez, through the chair, it would be up to DEED to have it to determine what infrequent is for the districts, and they would set the policy, and from my understanding, there would most likely be some type of reporting whenever a fundraiser was done that did not meet the healthy snack reporting. If they're healthy snacks, nothing has to be done. You can do it without any exemption whatsoever. So you could sell rice cakes all day long, and maybe you could give, like, you know, marshmallow dipping sauce for free and be okay.
I see no other questions, so we'll go to public testimony. Oh, Representative Christ Tompkins has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilson, do you have a sense why DEED hasn't adopted regulations that it's been able to, that this bill addresses?
Representative Christ Tompkins, Mr. Chair, I have no idea why they haven't decided to. We did get an email back that said they were looking into it, but thus far they have not done it.
Okay.
Is
there any letter from the United States Department of Education actually stating that this would not jeopardize school funding if the regulations set forth the standards of what constitutes infrequent?
Representative Kess, through the chair, it is part of the whole policy. It does give the variance that allows the Department of Education to write regulation as long as it's for infrequent. And so that's within the law itself. So this bill, what it does is that it directs the Department of Education to follow through with that. They could do that on their own if they so chose. They just haven't done it at this point, and thus, because they haven't, no fundraisers that are unhealthy snacks can be done.
Follow up? And then, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Follow up?
I defer to Representative Tallarico.
Representative. Thank you. If I could, thank you, Mr. Chairman, if I could ask the sponsor. Back to the title, your preference would be to remove health and social services and insert education and early development on line two?
Tallarico, through the chair, you could do it either way. You could just take out relating to the duties of the Department of Health and Social Service because it has to do with fundraisers, or you could put Department of Education. Either one would put the intent back in.
All right. Follow-up, Mr. Chairman, would it be an appropriate time then for me to suggest a conceptual amendment?
No, let's wait until we get public testimony, and then we'll give the opportunity for that. Okay. Thanks. Okay. Representative Vasquez?
Representative Wilson, in looking at page 3, lines 27 through 29, and I'll read it, subsection 18, adopt regulations authorizing schools to approve fundraisers involving the sale of foods that do not meet the food nutrition standards under 42 U.S.C. 1779. Where do we get the standard or the guidance that infrequent use of this exception will not get us into trouble with regard to federal funding? I want to see a document. I want to see something that actually tells us that we're not going to jeopardize federal funding, inadvertently at least.
Ms. Vasquez, through the chair, and we can make a copy of what's in my hand right now. This terminology came right out of the code that the federal government has. We did not make any of this up, what being infrequent versus frequent. This is actually in their law for the Healthy Stack 2010 that was passed. And we can make sure that each member has the actual rule, which is right here, that says that they have to be infrequent. Again, when we sent this to legal, our intent was to make it so that they can continue to do them as they have been doing. We were told by legal that could not be done. It had to be infrequent if we wanted to stay within the federal guidelines.
Follow-up?
Representative Wilson, can you please distribute that to the committee members?
The chair, absolutely.
That probably will answer the question I've been asking. So.
And I just want to call attention to the zero fiscal note that you have in front of you. There is a comment that the U.S. Code or Department of Education, I believe, has the regulations on this particular topic on the waiver. So.
Representative Wilson, a thought here. Since DEED, or the Department of Education and Early Development, have not issued proper regulations to implement this, should we have another provision requiring them to implement this provision appropriately?
Representative Keller, through the chair. Representative Vasquez, through the chair. Sorry about that. That's what this bill does. This requires them to write the regulation and implement it.
Where's that, Representative Wilson? Where's that directive to DEED?
It is adopt regulations authorizing schools to approve fundraisers involving the sale of foods that do not meet the food. What you refer to on page 3, once they adopt the regulations, then it becomes enacted, and the districts will then again be able to have fundraisers, you know, through whatever the procedure is that the Department of Education has determined. I would imagine what most have done, they've had a form that's filled out that says who it is that's doing the fundraiser, what they're trying to sell, and it would count against them. Some of them have made up to 30 a year, some 10 a year. Every state has been different, the ones that have done it. I would imagine that they would take input to find out what's currently going on in this.
Just on that point, Representative Vasquez, also the driver there is on page 1, line 5, where it says the department shall.
Okay.
Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah. Shall we put a time provision? It's just a thought. Just a thought.
Mr. Vasquez, through the chair, anything that gets them moving works for me. Thank you.
I'm just saying.
Oh, and Mr. Vasquez, through the chair, on page 3, section 2, the act takes effect immediately. But again, you know, it says it takes effect, it's effective immediately, but they haven't done them quickly. It was a very good point. So if you would like to have an amendment that just says specifically on a time limit, not past a certain date, so at least for this next school year, they would be able to do this. You know, and Mr. Chair, and I want to, you know, bring to the attention of, it just seems like this whole thing is so ironic, because, you know, I can bring whatever I want in my lunch and it's okay. I can bring something for a birthday party, it's okay. Somehow to say during the lunch hour, and that's when most of the fundraisers happen, that we're going to become so unhealthy because of that. Parents have control whether they give children money, you know, whatsoever. What schools can do, and I'm not too sure we want to go this way, is in the morning have all their fundraisers or right after school. And we're not stopping anything here, but I think to pretend that federal government needs to go into every aspect of our school is really what's kind of appalling about this particular one. And what does infrequent mean, as Representative Vasquez has said, that really is not even, you know, in the law now saying whether or not it's 10, 20, 30, 40. They have left it up to the department to figure out what that is.
Seeing no other questions, we're going to go to public testimony. And I guess one more. Is this a fundraiser? I mean, the dollar a piece at the back of the room after?
Mr. Chair, I brought it for your enjoyment. You may have either plateful you would like.
Okay. If we go online, let's go to Barbara Haney from North Pole. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Yes. My name is Barbara Haney, and my name has changed in spelling since I last testified a few minutes ago. I want to wholeheartedly support this bill, and I hope it's fast-tracked. Fundraisers are very critical for sports teams in the state, and now with tight fiscal conditions, these fundraisers will be absolutely important. For teams to go to state, to go to national or to world competitions, these fundraisers make all the difference in the world. I applaud Representative Wilson for sponsoring this bill, and I hope you guys can pass this and fast-track it onward. The U.S. Department of Education really has gone way out of their way in trying to regulate what snacks get sold at schools. I mean, this is so far beyond the 10th Amendment, it's unbelievable that it's even going on. And so I hope with due consideration that you do pass this, because there are people who have trained for years and all of a sudden they get to this point and they can't go because there's no funds because the state's broke and they can't have a fundraiser because of the federal government. It's ridiculous. So I hope you fast track it and I hope you support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you for taking time to call in. Patricia Lee.
Hi. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify this morning. I'm a PTA mom, a mother of five, soccer fundraiser coordinator, orchestra fundraiser coordinator. But I have some concerns about this bill that I hope that you will vet as you move forward. My first question, though, is I'm confused as to why the federal government would be blamed for Alaska not having a bill or process for having snacks in schools, since that's certainly our option and other states have done it. The next thing is that I'm concerned that what comes in to sell for fundraisers has no quality control. I once opened a package of goodies to be sold at a fundraiser at school, and it had either dog or rabbit hair in it. I mean, it was not. I know that if I want to go sell something at the farmer's market, I have to go through the ABEC and a particular process to make sure that what's coming in is safe. And I would assume that that should stand for birthday parties and everything else. So I'm not claiming to know all the ins and outs, but if we're going to have large-scale fundraising where things get bought from home and sold during the day at school, as a teacher, we also can't control how much of that is sugar that goes into kids. Not all snacks are sugars, but certainly a lot of them are. The next thing I'd like to mention is that I've seen fundraisers going on as I'm in and out of schools all the time at Fairbanks. For instance, chicken noodle soup and a nice roll, taquitos and other things being sold for travel fundraising. So I'm a little confused as to why there's some talk about that's not allowed, because I've seen it in many, many schools at lunchtime, and it doesn't seem to be hindered at all. And then my last concern is that
the more we depend on fundraisers, or we can say, hey, just have a fundraiser for this, or just have a fundraiser for that, takes the appropriate budgeting off the hook for supporting education. You know, will we be having fundraisers for your bus fare to school? I don't know. That might be going a little far, but I have that concern. And I guess as I finish up my testimony, my greatest concern is that if you want to sell something, there has to be some quality control measure involved. And I'm not sure in this bill where that would be. And what happens if kids eat something and they get sick and the school is blamed? I mean, it's been going on a long time, but times have also changed. So with that, I'll close my testimony and ask you to just please do your due diligence in this bill.
Thank you, Patrice. Thank you for your very much for your taking time to call in and giving us your perspective. I see no other testifiers online, and I don't have anybody sign up for in the room. So what I'm going to do is let the sponsor have a wrap-up, but then we're going to set the bill aside and come up with a we'll come back with a CS that has the title change and a potentially an amendment that will be worked out between Representative Vasquez and the sponsor. But Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Were we going to have the department up for questions on this bill?
If you would like, we can certainly do that.
Thank you.
We will do that. Okay. So thank you. And I'll go ahead and do your wrap-up. We'll do that, and then we'll have the department come up and get their comments. But go ahead. We might call you back if there's questions that come up.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to address a couple of the concerns Ms. Lee had. I don't believe you could just come in and do a fundraiser in the school. You have to have permission even at this point. You know, you have to talk about who it is that's having the fundraiser, where the funds are going to go, what you're going to be able to sell. There's been more and more restrictions on these types of things throughout the year, where it even for some schools it's even hard to even bring homemade snacks, even if it is for a birthday party. I've noticed that some have actually said that you can only have store-bought. So those are already up into the school. All this does is address a new federal regulation that came upon that just was enacted, that now puts a little bit more rules that goes in with it. Why the department hasn't done it, you know, maybe they just haven't had time. I guess my frustration is that, again, we're going to add more to school districts, because instead of saying you can use your best, you know, knowledge about what you need in your districts, we're now going to tell you what infrequent is. And then I'll guarantee you, because it's government, there's going to be more paperwork that's going to be spent on this versus in the classroom into the educational portion of it. However, that is kind of the rules that we're on. We do accept the money, and again, there is no free money. There are strings that are tied to it, and this is one of those. But I do think it's very important during these times that we do allow those organizations to be able to raise their own funds. Otherwise, I think you're going to see less band participation, less football teams, because, you know, there is very little bit of funding that comes to the state for these extracurricular activities, which we know adds to the school day with that. So with that, I appreciate that. I look forward to working with, you know, Representative Vasquez, and we'll get that to you as soon as we can.
Thank you. We'll let the State Department of Education come up on request here for questions or comments. When I first said that, I noticed there was all of a sudden less people in the room from the department. Everybody came back. Commissioner, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Mike Hannon, the Commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development.
Is there questions, Representative Seaton?
Thank you. I was wanting to know if the department is adopting currently regulations, or if there's any problem with this bill from the department's standpoint.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, this doesn't require regulations. The SEAs, the state agencies, are given the authority to provide those waivers, and those are already in the process of moving forward. I spoke to the school boards are in town, the AASB, Alaska Association of School Boards. I spoke to them yesterday and asked them, gave them the regulations from USDA around this smart snack language, and asked them for their input in regards to what kind of frequency do we need. So I spoke to them about giving them about a month or so to get that information back to me so we can develop some waivers.
Follow up? Yes. You know, some of the backup material that we have a USDA April 17th letter from nutrition, child nutrition programs, and it was indicating that that could not be left up to local educational agencies or food or school food authorities. Those were their LEAs or SFAs. Do you have a, am I misinterpreting what you're saying?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the SEAs, the state agencies, have been given the authority to work with the LEAs, the local education authorities, but the locals aren't allowed to set their own policies individually. They need to work through the SEA. So I'm trying to set parameters based on the what we see as the requirements of this these federal laws and the needs of our local school districts.
Any other questions for the department? So, Representative Seaton?
Thanks. So just a clarification, you're saying that the law requires a state agency must set an upper limit on the number of fundraisers that would be allowed. That doesn't have to be through regulation. That can be through another process that's recognized and would work in this system.
To the chair, that's correct. I've got a document. I shared it with the school board yesterday, but I don't have it with me today. I can surely get to this committee. It's very succinct, clear understanding of what that is. This comes from USDA, and then what other states have done, and you know the amount of waivers they've given, how long they can go. So I can surely give you that as a reference if you'd like.
Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate that coming. I haven't seen it. We appreciate it coming to the committee, so we have that too, and with the sponsor as well.
So if you could get that to Janet, I will distribute it. And we will come back with a CS and, you know, hopefully quick action the next time we bring it up. Anything else on this from the department?
Mr. Hanley, so the bottom line with regard to your testimony is you're stating that you do not need to adopt regulations to implement this provision in the proposed bill?
Through the chair, that's correct. I was unaware that this bill was coming forward, or I could have shared the fact that I had worked with my child nutrition services folks, the division. I've had that information for a little while, based on a conversation I had with folks from Ketchikan. So that's correct. We don't need a regulation to do this as per the federal outlines that we give the SEAs the authority to make some waivers.
Okay. Where's the, can you cite the federal provision you're relying on?
I can get that for you.
Okay.
I'm guessing it's right here, but I haven't handed it out.
It's more than... I think 12 pages.
Right.
And this only covers the local school wellness policy implementation under the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010, and it doesn't even... Those are proposed rules. What are the final rules? I mean, these are just proposed rules. What is the final rule?
Share the document that I provide you. We'll give you the reference, the federal regulatory or the federal or the regulatory reference. Ultimately, this we're moving in the same direction of one, recognizing federal law that has come down based on schools that participate in the school lunch and breakfast program, to the ability for us to give waivers for those particular situations that justify that, you know, based on local decisions. So we're moving in the same direction. I will say that if this bill passes, it will be slower than if I go forward and do it on my own. But if this bill passes, then I have to go forward and put a regulation in place. So for me to put a regulation in place, I go to the state board. It goes, it will probably be up in September. They meet quarterly. And then it has to go out for public comment period. So it'll come out in public comment period September. Then that would be December. Then it would be voted on and adopted. So I'm surely willing to follow that process if that's the will of this body. I think I would sure anticipate what I spoke to the school board yesterday about is that we could surely have something in place by next year, by the end of this school year.
Can I
follow?
Correction on the record, 14 pages, federal regulations. Okay, I'd like to see the final regulations. These are proposed regulations, and the date of February 26, 2014. So by now, we may have final regulations. I don't see the end of the comment period here. Mr. Hanley, the State Board meets quarterly. Are you saying the next quarterly meeting is in October?
No, they have a full agenda in June coming up. It's actually a three-day meeting with a retreat. And then they will meet. I say meet quarterly. They meet face-to-face quarterly. We also have additional meetings. But
so when is the next meeting, Mr.
The next
Hanley?
Meeting is in June.
Okay.
Representative Drummond?
I'm somewhat confused, Mr. Chair. If the department is already writing regulations based on things that they've heard from the community, and to pass this bill would slow down that process, I don't understand why we're even considering this bill.
Representative Drummond, we are considering it because we just got that information, and we're going to leave that discussion to go between EED and the sponsor, and that will determine our next steps. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vasquez.
Point of clarification, are you stating that DEED, the Department of Education and Early Development, is actually writing regulations at this point in time?
No. To the chair, no, that's not what I testified.
What did you testify to first?
I testified to the fact that USDA allows SEAs, state education agencies, the department, to set up statewide waivers to the federal law. And that's what we're in the process of doing.
And just a point of clarification, a waiver isn't necessarily a regulation. It can be just a memo.
Correct.
Right. Okay, any other questions?
Yeah,
Representative Vasquez.
When will those be, those statewide waivers, are they going to be in memo forms? In what format?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, I haven't determined exactly what format. We'll have a format that goes directly to USDA so they know where we stand, as well as to all of our school districts. A memo seems to be an appropriate format, but I haven't determined that yet.
Okay. And why were regulations not considered?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, I'm not a big advocate for adding regulations when we don't need them. This was a pretty straightforward, clear opportunity for us to provide needed exemptions for our local school districts without going through that process. And yet, I felt the need. The one positive thing about regulations is there is a built-in public comment period. So with a lack of that, I chose to work directly with our school boards to get that public input.
What is?
Representative Vasquez.
When will those waivers be issued? Is it district by district or statewide waiver?
Through the chair, my goal would be a statewide rather than doing individual waivers. I think that makes the most sense. And that's my goal at this time. I gave the school boards I said about a month. I'm going to send it to the head of the school boards association so we can get some clarity around, you know, specific dates that I'd like some deadlines or some information back by. So if that's a month, that's, you know, beginning of May. It won't take much time after that, so we can have something by the end of May. What I told them is it sure seemed feasible by the end of the school year.
Okay.
So, point of
Representative Vasquez, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. So you're going to start getting feedback from the school boards?
Through the chair, yes. And I'm going to do that. I'm going to ask them to submit it to the head of their organization. That way they can bring it all together. They're in the loop. So that is currently Joseph Reeves and newly elected Norm Wooten to work with the school boards directly. It seems to be the cleanest way to get that information.
Mm-hmm. Okay, with that, we'll put the bill aside, and thank you for coming up to testify. And I want to recognize Representative Reinbold. I don't know when you came in, Representative Reinbold. I was a little preoccupied with my bill, so recognize the fact that you're here. On Wednesday, we will please come prepared to continue our work on HB 52, which is Representative Herron's bill on a fund for museums. And also HB 102, which is our committee bill on the RPTCs, the Residential Psychiatric Treatment Centers, and also HB 163, if the sponsor determines to press on for committee action. So with that, we're adjourned at 10:52.